want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support this program, and your humble host is grateful to Steve Wozinski, Faith Peoples, Joseph, no last name, in San Francisco, and Mark Brodsky in Illinois. If you're able and you'd like to help, drop by my website, peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage, there are links to PayPal, and you can take out a voluntary subscription for as little as $5 a month. In the second segment of this podcast today, Rinku Sen returns. She is president and executive director of the Applied Research Center. And their new study shows that it appears to be government policy to break up immigrant families, where the children are American citizens and the parents are deported, leaving those children as orphans. Jack Abramoff is working on rehabilitating his image, and 60 Minutes did him a big favor on Sunday evening, the 6th of November, as Leslie Stahl peppered him with softballs, and Jack Abramoff was well rehearsed. He's a very smart and arrogant fellow, and those talents served him well, as he dodged a lot of important questions, and Leslie Stahl didn't bother to ask about critical aspects. To get a little balance, we go to Tom Rogers. He is a member of the Blackfoot Indian Nation in this country. He was the main whistleblower in the Abramoff scandal, and he has received academic ethics awards for his efforts. The Tom C. Rogers O.T. Pam Sowook Ethics in Government Scholarship by the University of Denver Sturm College of Law was named in his honor. How did I do on that that foreign language? That's not my first tongue, Tom.
Well, Peter, you did an excellent job. That is a Cree Indian word, and you got it almost right on spot on. It's Otitumsawak, which is Cree for the a person who owns himself.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's start right there, because Leslie Stahl seemed aghast that Jack Abramoff at his peak, quote-unquote, owned 100 Republican members of Congress. And clearly those people were not speaking for themselves or operating right in their own interests, and neither were they operating in the interests of the public that they
right
swore to represent when they took an oath of office. So what is your take on what Abramoff is attempting and the extent to which CBS and 60 Minutes are enablers for him?
What's disappointing and not informative, Peter, is that This scandal was one of the largest, and this wasn't me speaking, this was the Washington Post and the New York Times, one of the largest congressional scandals in U.S. history. It was the largest scandal for lobbying in U.S. history, and it was so far-reaching that it caused the United States Senate to flip in power from Republican control to Democratic control in 2006, when Senator John Tester from Montana beat Senator Conrad Burns, who had been tied to and affiliated with some of Jack and his staff, being Senator Burns' staff, had been called into question on his workings with Jack Abramoff and his associates. So what this required was a much more aggressive, a much more detailed examination than simply saying, oh, I hate you, oh, that's terrible. She took, Ms. Stahl, unfortunately, took kind of a very liberal effrontery and a personal effrontery, as opposed to informing the American public of the scope and the breadth and the damage that this gentleman did. He moved, as you know, Peter, from apathy to skepticism to outright cynicism. And this gentleman, just to give you the darkness of his deflection, as you saw last night, that it was everybody's fault but him, is that him and his associates, when they had exhausted one of the tribes that they allegedly worked for, and they noticed that the tribe, the Tigua tribe of El Paso, would have to close down their Native American gaming operation because they were forced, we were being forced to by the state of Texas, they had to let almost 400 people go out of work in El Paso, Texas. And for you who've never been to El Paso, you know it's extreme poverty. And they had billed them for over $5 million. But that was not enough, Peter. They had to come back and take their dignity, too. They came back. Him and Michael got on a plane and said, fire up the jet, baby. We're on our way to El Paso. And they presented to the tribal council in El Paso, the Tiguas, and they said, well, I know you can't pay your fees anymore, but how about if we do this? How about if we take out life insurance policies on your parents and grandparents, and when they die, we will cash in those death bets, as I call them, and we will apply those insurance death bets to our lobbying bill. Now, how's that for darkness?
Well, he is very comfortable there on the dark side. He came out from under a rock. But,
right.
But Tom, one of the things that's really critical for me is that Leslie Stahl made it appear that Tom DeLay was a victim, like other members of Congress, maybe a victim of laziness for not reading the bill before he rammed it through a committee, that sort of thing. But Tom DeLay was a co-conspirator with Abramoff. Tom DeLay set up the K Street Project to enable Abramoff and others to buy legislation. They made campaign contributions, either directly to campaigns or to leadership PACs or to party campaign funds, and then they were permitted to submit pre-written legislation. And that's how the K Street Project worked. And Leslie Stahl didn't mention that even in passing.
No, it was very dispiriting, Peter. It was essentially the buying and selling of America. And they had reduced it to a corporate business, just like a manufacturing cycle. The checks come in, the access is granted, the expertise of lobbying, of writing a bill, is farmed out to corporate America. Then it is put into a bill in the United States Congress, and out the other side comes a special favor for those specific interests, and specifically that ideological agenda that Mr. DeLay and Mr. Abramoff had. But the problem there with these people is it's a failure of their human psyche and their own self-awareness, and what motivates them, is power, greed, and money. And that's who was running the Congress at that point in time.
The other character who was given a complete pass in the 60 Minutes piece was Ralph Reed, who is the guy who preaches that he's holier than everybody else. But he got down in the dirt with Abramoff and worked with Abramoff to pick off one Native American tribe against another, and then bring in the evangelicals who would be against one sort of gambling, for example, a state lottery, so that Native American casinos might prevail. And the skullduggery and the manipulation, particularly of the Native American tribal leaders, really represents a new low since Manifest Destiny and the way we scrubbed the Great Plains of Native Americans.
Right. There, Mr. Reed, remember in his quotes, and a person reveals his character when he conducts his business when and he feels that no one is watching him, and then you get into a real insight into his awareness or lack of awareness. He said after he left the Christian Coalition that he needed to get humping in corporate accounts. In fact, even Jack, in an email to one of his associates, said, Ralph Reed is an even darker version than us. Once again, it was all about the money and the power. And unfortunately, he's back. These people never go away, Peter. They just, you know, no one ever goes to Elba and says, you know what, we're not coming back. Well, they're back. And now Ralph Reed has his, if you can believe it, his values coalition is, you know, he's involved in the primary races. And he said just the other day, I don't know who I'm going to support for president. I have lots of friends. If this gentleman had any shame, and once again, both him, DeLay, and Rell, and Mr. Abramoff confuse fame with infamy. They don't know the difference between the two, unfortunately.
And Tom, one other omission, and then I'll get off my soapbox and let you talk a little bit. But the thing that drove me bonkers as I watched the 60 Minutes piece, and it's on the same show with the obituary for Andy Rooney, and I certainly recommend that people watch the Andy Rooney segment. But Leslie Stahl failed to even mention the case of Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama. He's been on 60 Minutes. If she only watched her own goddamn TV show, she would have thought, oh, yeah, he was a victim of Abramoff. He got caught up in these gaming scandals because Don Siegelman was trying to pass a state lottery in Alabama to support education. And that conflicted with the desires of Abramoff represented Native American tribes. And so what did they do? They unloaded one of the most amazing conspiracies in modern American history that is still in play. The Obama administration hasn't dealt with it or attempted to fix it. And Don Siegelman was sentenced to 7 years in federal prison for accepting a campaign contribution that didn't even go into his own campaign. It went into this lottery education campaign. Yet they convicted him under an honest services statute that was declared invalid when Ted Stevens was convicted under it. And so it just amazes me that not a word was mentioned about Don Siegelman, who remains in the docks. He's free on bail, but his case is up on appeal, and he's hit a lot of roadblocks, and largely because the Democratic Obama holder Justice Department refuses to drop the charges against him, refuses to acknowledge the corruption in that case from Laura Canary, the prosecutor, up to Judge Fuller, who has no business, Mark Fuller, presiding over that case. And yet, you know, she didn't call Jack Abramoff to comment on that whatsoever. And the missing Karl Rove White House emails that were suddenly found when the statute of limitation expired, those weren't commented. So the way that 60 Minutes took Abramoff and basically made him into the next Michael Milken, bad things happened. He regrets what occurred, and now he wants to get on with his life. And we're just supposed to forget about all the damage that he did.
You're absolutely. What was... Like I said, is the packaging last night, Peter, of that episode. You saw there was no hard-hitting questions. There was no follow-up. There was no additional witnesses to testify to this incredible dark side of this individual. There was complete deflection, like I said, pathological on his point. There was no ownership of his accountability on this at all. The fact that the way it was presented, the way that even if you went later on and you saw the web extra portion of the episode, you saw where Jack barely attempted to say, well, I wasn't the most immoral. I wasn't the most immoral in this. Then who was? What we were seeing is, once again, a mainstream media packaging, which is more like a celebrity magazine. It had nothing to do with information. It had nothing to do with accountability. All it dealt with was, here he is. This is what he said. He should have paid to be on that show, you know, given the marketing that it gave him last night, that it was everybody else's fault but mine. And when I've been going to all of these sentencing, Peter, here at the U.S. District Courthouse in Washington, D.C., all of these men who get up there, they're so sorry. They're sorry to their families and their children. And once again, what I reiterate, a man reveals himself when no one is watching by his character and his actions. And what they did, what about their character, and what about their families? Did they notice what they were doing when they were sending these emails calling us Native Americans troglodytes, retards, and morons, and then saying, hey, chief, you better pay up, or it'll be another trail of tears, or, hey, too bad, stupid people get wiped out. Here you have a population of this country subjected to genocide 150 years ago, and now we have this, sanctioned and enabled by certain politicians. And we haven't learned anything, apparently, because even coming out of that, there should have been a much more in-depth, especially pairing it with a great legacy of Andy Rooney. And to have that surface treatment last night was extremely dispiriting.
Tom Rogers, take a moment to explain to our listeners the role that you played in exposing what Jack Abramoff was up to.
Well, Peter, thank you. I'm a Blackfoot Native American. My reservation is near Glacier Park. That was our Aboriginal lands when I was a child. That said, is a couple of tribal leaders way back in 2002 and 2003 who I'd never met before but heard that they could trust me, came to me, and asked me if I would help them because their lobbyist was threatening them, defrauding them, and cheating them, and stealing their money. And so, and on, and it was never, Peter, about money. I've never had any of these gentlemen as clients or their tribes. And it was not about Republican versus Democrat. That is too trivial. It was all about my mother, who's a Blackfoot Native American woman, who has tremendous empathy for her people and for other people. And I couldn't turn away when these people asked for help. And what we did then, Peter, when we didn't get any help from Congress, when we didn't get any help from the administration, I said, we need to go another way, and we need to leak this to the media. But we need to leak it to the local media because they're hungry. The mainstream media won't understand us. They won't get us. They'll tell us it's an internal matter. They'll tell us, oh, you know, aren't all you tribes wealthy? And I said, no. So we leaked it to the local media. Then we worked it up the media food chain until they couldn't turn away. And now we have what we have.
And so explicitly, what did you leak and how did that percolate up to the point where the corporate media had to take attention, had to pay attention?
What we did is I collected all of the invoices, the $1.875 million invoices, Peter, for the three words, for services rendered. Services rendered. Then we did a portfolio examination of Jack's history, the fact that he worked for terrorists in Angola, UNITA, terrorist organization.
Right.
The fact that he had worked for the South African Apartheid Intelligence Services. And we put this all into a portfolio, and we mailed it to the Mount Pleasant Morning News in Michigan, the Lake Charles American Press in Louisiana, and every branch where Greenberg Traurig had a Native American client. We mailed it to the local newspaper. We mailed it to all the good government groups in this country. And then I mailed it to Peter Stone at National Journal and Susan Schmidt at the Washington Post. And then the mainstream media couldn't turn away after we had the local media hound them on this. We leaked it to the national media, and then I turned around and I contacted Pablo Carrillo, who is Senator John McCain's lead investigator, and I said, Mr. Carrillo, I think I can help you up on Capitol Hill with regard to Mr. Abramoff. And he said, how soon can you be up here? And then it began.
And did the group crew, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, in your view, did they help in this matter?
Yes, they did. I mean, they have constantly shined a light on political donations, the lack of transparency with political donations. And in this town, as you might be aware, Peter, in this country, fear is probably one of the most, you know, unfortunately, negative emotions you can have. So there were not too many people who, at that time, remember, this was during the period of what people need to remember in that early post 9/11 period. We had the president's press secretary tell the media to watch what they say because the White House was watching. So there was an enormous amount of fear at that time. But the crew did. What I sought to do, what the other tribal leaders who I worked with sought to do, was to kind of shine a light on this because we knew it was wrong. And the thing that I'm most proud of, Peter, is we did it when it mattered, and we didn't do it for money, and we didn't do it for fame. We just knew that the Native Americans were being taken advantage of again. No one would pay attention to us, and we couldn't turn away.
Now, has Abramoff repaid any of the money that he stole from the Native American tribal groups?
Oh, I think I think he still has an outstanding bill of $22 million. I know his law firm, Greenberg Traurig, has paid a substantial sum, but that has been paid by insurance. So how much he still has left, I cannot say. But he still has an outstanding balance of about $22 million. And his other partner, Michael Scanlon, who's at equally at fault, if not even more dark than Jack Abramoff, also has a substantial amount to pay. And now there's litigation going on between Greenberg Traulig and Mr. Scanlon. But the tribes will never be made whole. Tens of millions of dollars were stolen from them. And that's another thing, Peter, that people need to be aware of. These people always talk about their children and their families as they cry in front of the judge here in Washington, D.C. And I went to a sentencing the other day, which was almost like a pep rally, Peter. This gentleman, Mr. Ring, had all of his supporters there, his family. And while I feel bad for his family and his children, it was more like a pep rally. And what is being forgotten, because it's just like that great statement by Schultz and Eason, where it's not enough to contest the lie, you've got to defeat the lie. I had two lobbyists as I exited the building. I wasn't there for any sense of triumphalism, Peter. I was only there to see if any of them, would apologize to the Native American people of this country. Not one has, other than Neil Votes, who walked up to me crying and saying, Tom, I am so sorry for what we did to your people. And not one of them in that courtroom has turned to the Native people and said, we are sorry for cheating you, defrauding you. Please forgive me. If there was any sense of justice in this country, Jack, Michael, Tony, Steve Griles, Kevin Ring, all of them should go up to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and be made to serve the children and elders of one of the poorest communities in this entire United States. And then maybe there would be a sense of justice. But until that occurs, no amount of money, no amount of deflection, and I said pathological deflection, will suffice. And that's where we are, but we've got to continually remember, not to become a victim, but to remember so it informs you, so we can hold these people accountable, because Ralph Reed is coming back. Jack Abramoff is coming back. They're all back, Peter.
Now, you referenced Neil Volz. He was the chief of staff to Ohio Congressman Bob Ney, who was on 60 Minutes on the program and acknowledged that he inserted legislation on behalf of Abramoff that he didn't even understand.
Right.
And Bob Ney does seem to be more remorseful and apologetic than many. But I need a little input from you on this, because Bob Ney now works for an outfit called Talk Radio News in Washington, which is run by a friend of mine named Ellen Ratner. And on the one hand, I have been supportive of people released from prison and helped them find work, and
right.
I am a forgiving person. On the
right.
other hand, Bob Ney seems to be somewhat detached from the damage that he did, and he seems to still have a deer in the headlights kind of reaction, because he was the only one, only member of Congress who actually went to jail for this. Tom DeLay may actually end up behind bars at some point, but not for the Abramoff issues. So what is your sense of Bob Ney, and should we accept his apologies and embrace his recovery?
Well, I think Bob has made an attempt, and I think it's a serious attempt, to seek redemption, seek forgiveness, and to speak truth. But I think this is such a dark chapter in our nation's history. It is the end of his life as he would have liked it to have been. And you see that with all of the people who are now judged by the judicial branch. And so there is almost a need to compartmentalize it, a need to not go completely there. Because to do so is too disturbing to their own psyche. Now, both Neil and Bob have made, on a comparative basis, a much more genuine, a much more thoughtful, a much more self-aware attempt to explain what they did and why they did it, and at least say, I am sorry, and at least say, I was at fault. All the others go down the line, are still in denial, are still in deflection, and they can't confront it. But to confront it, just like what Jack and Michael and all the rest did, is by referring to Native Americans as subhuman. That way, they could rationalize their behavior because we were not deserving of being treated as humans. And they are still compartmentalizing it. So because the abject horror of trying to face what they did, Peter, is too great, and it'll jar them. But I think that both Bob and Neil have made a genuine, serious attempt. Have they went all the way? Perhaps not. But that'll be between them and their creator whenever they get there.
And Tom, I would like to see these people who did so much damage to not only the cause of Native Americans, but individual Native Americans. I'd like to see them lead the charge to free Leonard Peltier. I'd like to see them lead the charge to get the Department of the Interior to finally acknowledge the billions that are owed to Native Americans for resource fees and lots of other money that has been due to them for decades. And we continue to play games as people live in poverty and die.
Well, you hit it, Peter. You know, I just attended Eloise Cabell's funeral. For those who don't know who Eloise is, she's also a Blackfoot tribal member, and she led the court case to have an adjudication and an accounting of all of the oil and gas royalties and the fractionated oil and gas royalties that are owed to tribes for over 100 years. And you are right, Peter. This, what is somewhat disturbing is there's not an acknowledgement or an accounting that it literally took three Native Americans, Bernie Sprague of the Saginaw Chippewas, David Sickey of the Cushadas of Louisiana, and Tom Rogers, a Blackfoot Indian from Browning, Montana, to expose the largest lobbying scandal in U.S. history. This little team, and once again, Peter, not for money or for fame, but no one else would acknowledge it. Everybody was too afraid. As one friend to me said, Tom, are you prepared for them to expose everything in your life to be the messenger that they attack on a daily basis when it's Tom DeLay, Karl Rove, Steve Griles, who was number two at Interior?
Right. I remember him.
So you've got all of that lineup, and people got to have to remember what it was like right after 9/11, because that was the atmosphere. In fact, there's a great... that was the atmosphere we were facing at that point in time. And a lot of people don't remember that, Peter, and that needs to be remembered.
Well, I, for one, believe that at least to some extent that fear was generated by the Bush administration as a way of really pacifying the American people to accept mm-hmm. the far-fetched claims of a need to go to war in Iraq. And the tax cuts, I mean, the whole package was designed to really play on the fear that was generated. And you know, fear up is a military term that was used in the manual of how to debase the individuals who were being interrogated at Guantanamo and elsewhere. So I don't want to take you too far afield into my politics, but my point is that these are interconnected. That yes. the fear that was generated post 9/11 was part of an effort to make the rich richer and to take that money from poor people in this country. And that transfer of wealth is now very clear to even average Americans. And I believe that's one of the reasons that these Occupy protests have drawn so much support, and it's so broad and widespread.
Well, Peter, you're right. I mean, like I said earlier, we've moved from apathy to skepticism to outright cynicism, which is self-blindedness. Because once again, there you can compartmentalize it, and you can no longer be that kind of romantic idealist that would think that all things are possible. And it's a way of checking out of the system and manipulating it. And I, as a young boy, I could never understand when I was reading how this great country could have taken the Japanese people and seized their homes, their businesses, and their dreams. And ironically, and here is the irony, send them off to Indian reservations and warehouse them during World War II. But after 9/11, after 2001, 2002, 2003, and the run-up to the Iraq War And what, if you remember, I never felt more ashamed to be an American than the day that before we went to war, and that press conference. And what I'm saying is my remarks are specifically about the president's press conference when all of the questions were scripted, and they took Helen Thomas and put her in the back row because this administration, the previous administration, did not want any hard questions asked, and no one, hardly anyone in this country, wanted to ask the hard questions. And for that, we have thousands of who are dead, billions and trillions of dollars in redistribution of wealth. We have Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, and that's what happens when people allow the most negative emotion, fear, which even outstrips greed, to inhibit your free exercise of democracy. And we sold our democracy in that, in those years, but it's nice that we emerge from it, but now we need, as I said before, that great line, it's not enough to contest the lie, you have to defeat the lie. And we have to defeat this lie of Jack Abramoff and Ralph Reed and all of them.
Now, Tom, I understand that you are planning to tag along with Jack Abramoff on his book tour. He has this book out called Capital with an O, Capital Punishment. And tell me what your plans are. Are you going to shadow him from city to city?
Well, we're in the process of planning what our execution is going to be, but I am going to hold him accountable in the media by whatever means possible in order to once again contest the lie that he puts out there that it was the system's fault. The system is in place. You know, a process is put in place, Peter, as you know, to, you know, if you needed... If man were an angel, we wouldn't need laws or regulations. Well, look what's happened on Wall Street. Look what happened when we did not have any laws and regulations. And what individuals unfettered by process-checking institutions can do. And they almost brought this world to a financial and economic collapse. And so what you need to do is hound these people until they take accountability, until they are genuine in their sense of remorse, and I saw none of it last night. And that just motivated me more, and that's why we're going to hound him and hold him accountable and call him out. And for those reporters and mainstream news investigative bureaus who lob these softballs across the plate, it's also to call them out, to inform the American public, so the American public, because remember, Peter, you know this, journalism is the first page of history. We're not going to let them do this again. We're not going to let them do it again.
Well, Tom, if you have an opportunity to encounter Abramoff or get a question to him, if there's room to ask about Don Siegelman, that's one of the cases I'd like to hear him talk about, and I'd like to hear his apology. My final question for you is, with this book, I recognize that he wasn't sentenced to prison for a murder charge. But doesn't the Son of Sam law kick in, and isn't it illegal for him to benefit from a book about the crimes that he committed?
Yes, there is the a statute in that regard. I know that there has been some discussions, and I've seen both the Justice Department and the court going back and forth on exactly what they will do with the monies that will flow from this book. Hopefully, it'll all be worked out and that justice will prevail so that he cannot, once again, the true irony is he steals not only the Native American dream, but an American dream of hope and opportunity and democracy, and it just contributes to this cancerous of cynicism, which is so prevalent in our country. And look what it's done to our youth. Look at the people on Occupy Wall Street and cities all across the United States who have had to check out now, because they don't believe in hope anymore. They don't believe in opportunity. And here he's running around with this unalloyed cynicism, which acts like a cancer. And it's incredibly sad, and that's why you need to contest it and check him at all points so that you can talk to the youth of America and say, you know what, there is hope, there is opportunity. And if you do, one or two people, in our situation, three people came together, who became brothers, who never met for 2 years while we worked on this, Peter, never met. We did it all over the phone, but you can make a difference. One, two, or three. I took a chance on David and Bernie, and they took a chance on me. And we became incredibly close. And we changed history. And you can do that if you're passionate, your perseverance, and most importantly, you have empathy. Because if you don't have empathy, you can't be moral. And we've lost sight of this in this country. We need to take care of our brothers. And we've forgotten that lesson. And if you're empathetic and you feel the pain and hurt of others, you need to extend that hand.
Well, Tom, I'm grateful for what you and your Native American brothers did to bring the light of day and some media attention to Jack Abramoff. It ultimately led to his conviction. And I'm glad that you're out there fighting for the truth today, starting with that awful segment on 60 Minutes. Is there a website you'd like to tell our listeners about where they can follow your efforts to keep Jack Abramoff honest?
Oh, absolutely. Just go to CarlisleConsult.com. And Carlisle is spelled C-A-R-L-Y-L-E. That's C-A-R-L-Y-L-E, my middle name, and it's CarlisleConsult.com. You'll find a trove of a timeline on there, all the information you want, and we're going to continue this fight until this man either owns up to what he did or has a true sense of remorse as to what he's done to this country and to people's dreams.
CarlisleConsult.com. You're not affiliated with the Carlisle Group, I take it.
I am not. In fact, I take great pride, Peter. That is my middle name given to me by my wonderful mother, who loved the writer Thomas Carlyle, who was born in Dublin, Northern Ireland. Excuse me, Dublin, Ireland, Republic of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And she named me after him. It has no affiliation whatsoever with the Carlisle Group, and I am proud of that fact.
Well, it's a real pleasure to talk with you today. And since we mentioned Leonard Peltier, after our segment and before the next segment here on the podcast program today, I'm going to play a song that Robbie Robertson released in the 1990s, which includes the voice of Leonard Peltier as he explains what happened on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which ultimately led to his conviction and his long-term incarceration. I hope to see the day when Leonard Peltier walks free and is alive to enjoy what is left of his life.
His life. Thank you very much, Peter.
Tom Rogers, a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for doing what you are doing. As promised, here's Robbie Robertson from his CD called Contact from the Underworld of Red Boy. You're about to hear the voice of Leonard Peltier. The song is called Sacrifice.
We have a million stories to tell. I'm just one of a million or more stories that can be told. Troopers. John Edgett was murdered. Indian people. The prosecutor stated that they did not know who killed their agents, nor did he know what participation Leonard Peltier may have played in it. But someone has to pay for the crime. There's a lot of nights that I played my cell and understand why this hell and this terror that I've been going through for 21 years hasn't ended.
The human rights violations against immigrants to this country have reached a new high, or perhaps you'd want to refer to it as an all-time low. And there is a new study that details these issues, and we are going to be talking in this program's segment today with the president and executive director of the Applied Research Center, Rinku Sen, who has been on our program before. She's the author of The Accidental American: Immigration and Citizenship in the Age of Globalization, and she has been working on these issues for many years and appeared on our program once before. Rinku Sen, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Really
and
glad to join you.
We're going to describe here a study, and I think it's always important to give a little sketch of the issues that you're focusing on and the structure of the study that you conducted. But you basically analyzed the plight of children of immigrants and those who get separated from parents when they are taken into custody or deported. And you studied these child welfare issues in Arizona, California, Florida, North Carolina, New York, and Texas. And these states account for about half of the non-citizen population and about a third of the children in foster care. What else would you like to say about the methodology of your study?
Right. Well, one of the important things about this study is that it's the first national data that has ever been gathered on the families that find themselves at this intersection of child welfare departments and immigration enforcement. So we started with those six states because they had certain characteristics, high numbers of kids in their child welfare departments, large foreign-born population, and also aggressive approaches to immigration enforcement. We went to all of those places and we actually interviewed and surveyed child welfare caseworkers and family court judges and parents' attorneys and all the different people in the system to understand from them how many of their current cases, you know, if we were to take a snapshot in time right this minute, how many of your current cases represent people who are living in this intersection. And once we had that number, once we had a number from those six states, we actually projected it out to 14 additional states that have similar characteristics. So all of that amounted to us figuring that there are 5,000, at the very least, 5,000 kids in child welfare systems across the country who are in severe danger of never seeing their families again.
Well, and let's give people a scenario of how this works. You have an excellent chart in the executive summary of your report describing the anatomy of a case. And these, you know, the situations can vary, but there is some consistency that when undocumented immigrant families who have children who are American citizens because they were born here, when they make contact with local law enforcement authorities, they often lose control of the situation. They may have wanted a cop to come and investigate a burglary or some sort of a domestic disturbance. But once there is contact with the authorities, this train gets rolling and is very hard to stop. Tell us what happens when police intervene with the kind of family that I just described, and in particular, what happens to the kids.
Well, here's a story that we've discovered in New Mexico. We met two sisters in New Mexico who were undocumented immigrants, and one night or early one morning, federal agents stormed down their door. One of the sisters was at work working the night shift. The other sister was at home with three kids, her own child and her niece and nephew. Federal agents stormed down the door because they had gotten a tip that these sisters were dealing drugs. They searched the house for drugs, and they never found any drugs, and they never actually filed any charges, but they took the sister who was at home away to jail. The Child Protective Services came and got the kids. When the other sister came home from work late that morning, Immigration and Customs Enforcement was waiting for her. They took her off to jail. And even though no charges were ever filed, rather than just getting out of jail and picking up their kids, which is what would happen in any other situation, the two sisters were sent to detention, to immigrant detention. Their social worker could now no longer find them, didn't even know where they were, lost complete track of them for several months. The sisters were deported, and only once they were deported by working with the Mexican consulate were they able to get their kids back after more than a year of separation. And the baby in this case was 9 months old, so by the time the baby got back to his mother, he didn't remember her. Now, that's a lucky family, if you can believe that. In many of the cases, in many of the interviews we did, child welfare workers told us, once a family is deported, once a parent is deported, it's over for that family. We have to start moving toward severing the ties between the child and the parent forever. What happens is that when someone someone is in immigrant detention, they basically cannot participate in a reunification plan. The Child Welfare Department cannot any longer really involve that family fully in making that plan and in carrying it out. So the presence of immigration enforcement hugely increases the chances that these families will be separated forever.
So what I'm hearing here, and this is, you know, part of my larger observation about the problems with this system, is A, there is a de facto policy of separating parents from children and disappearing the parents. They go into the immigration detention system where they are basically in a black hole. They are disappeared. And the other piece here is there appears to be a de facto policy of aggressively pursuing these cases, even when no crime was committed and when a police call did not result in any charges being filed against anybody. And so these are real provocative approaches, and the losers here are first and foremost the children, and secondarily the parents who end up separated and often may never see these kids again.
Yeah, that is really correct, Peter. You know, the Obama administration and the Department of Homeland Security has insisted that in this time where we're deporting historic numbers of people, in 2009 we deported 400,000 people, and we've never deported at those rates before. And when you talk to the administration and ICE about it, they say we are only deporting people who have criminal convictions and who are really hardened lawbreakers. But in fact, we find that about half of the people who are deported have no charges against them whatsoever. And of the remainder, many of those people are actually charged with the things that are come along with being an undocumented immigrant. So false social security number and things like that. So the notion that we are only deporting, you know, the worst of the worst is really just a fantasy. That is not what's going on. And
deporting
is a lot of parents of U.S. citizen kids.
Now, excuse me, let's not use euphemisms here. It's a lie. It's not just a fantasy.
That's right.
This is an outright lie coming from the Obama administration and the Secretary of Homeland Security. And they want us to believe what is not true. And
yeah,
one of the reasons they can get away with it is that, you know, I use the term disappeared. That has loaded references coming from the Central and South American countries in the 1980s. But we are disappearing people. And when they go into the INS detention system, most of these facilities, well, maybe I'm wrong about that, many of them are privately run, these private prisons run by Wackenhut and CCA. And they are these lawless pens where people are held. And I interviewed a guy who was working at one of these private prisons last year, and the stories are horrendous of women who either voluntarily to try to improve their status or because of intimidation or outright force submit to sex with male guards and administrators. And the whole way that these are operated, where mostly these people are sent to prisons far away from where they were arrested and where their children are, and this gets into another key issue, that when the children are taken into custody by Child Protective Services, the parents cannot participate in the proceedings about the disposition of their children because they are locked up and cannot be reached. They are placed out of reach, even of the court systems that they are required to respond to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As you mentioned, Peter, many of these detention centers for immigrants are run, they are privately run. It is the growth industry in the prison system now. That is where the corporations you mentioned are investing their energy because that's what they know is going to be growing. They are largely unregulated. No one goes in to check on the conditions and to make sure that there are humane conditions there. And we know from many studies that people are dying in these detention centers. So the parent, the immigrant parent, who needs to get to family court or needs to be able to call their social worker or needs to be able to visit their kids, in a situation like that, that parent has no chance whatsoever to have any kind of involvement in a reunification plan. And ICE could do a lot of things differently here. They could look at alternatives to detention. Someone who is trying to get their kid out of child welfare is not a very high flight risk, and so it should be entirely possible, even if someone becomes involved in ICE enforcement, to just let them be out on their own recognizance and to stop the clock on the deportation long enough for that family to resolve its situation.
Rinku, can you give me a sense, just a ballpark figure, of how many of the INS detention centers are privatized?
My understanding, I don't have a number, but my understanding that is that it's actually most of them, that it's the majority. So I would say more than half for sure, and it could be as high as 80%.
And you mentioned that there's no oversight or inspection of these facilities. Is there any desire? Is there even a single member of Congress who has raised these issues and said, I'd like to inspect one of these facilities?
Well, the Detention Watch Network has begun a campaign to get Americans and to get legislatures to take a look, a hard look at detention systems and to change them. And they've really called for a moratorium on immigration detention. And there are members of Congress like Raul Grijalva and others who have drawn attention. Barbara Lee has done this, and there are a number of other people in Congress who have tried to get people to think about what's happening in detention. But really, I think the problem is that our immigration debate is so polarized, and it has been, we are in such an enforcement-only kind of climate with regard to immigration that most of us, too many Americans, are unable to really see the collateral consequences of the enforcement-only approach that we're taking, and there isn't nearly enough attention from politicians or anyone else to what happens to people when they're in detention, what are the actual consequences of having local police officers enforce immigration law. We have found a story, for example, in which a woman who is a victim of domestic violence called the police because her abuser was going to kill her. When the police came, they arrested her along with the abuser. The children were sent off to Child Protective Services. And even though the Violence Against Women Act requires immigration and ICE to make special arrangements for victim of domestic violence and other crimes, this woman found no such special arrangements and has been having to fight deportation at the same time as she's trying to get her kids back and finding it virtually impossible to get her kids back. So even the laws that are already on the books that say ICE should exercise its discretion in making decisions about parents, those laws and those regulations, those guidelines, are not being followed by that institution.
And one other member of Congress does come to mind, Gutierrez, congressman from Chicago, has been pretty outspoken about these issues. And so I don't want to make it seem like there are zero members of Congress who care, but we're not seeing much in the way of efforts to draw attention to or fix some of these problems. Now, Rinku, in one of the footnotes of your study, I was intrigued because there was a reference to Skype. And, for example, you point out in your report that most of the undocumented people who are taken into custody are sent to a holding facility, usually 300 miles or more from the scene that they were picked up at. And they are unable to participate. And even in the county where they were taken into custody, the officials who have the children cannot reach the parent. And Skype is a very easy way, and it's free. At this time of broke governments, it doesn't cost the taxpayers any more for a Skype connection to the detention facility to connect them to Child Protective Services or a court so that that parent can participate in the proceedings related to their child, who is most likely an American citizen.
Right. You know, one of the issues here is that the policies and practices of child welfare departments also are all over the map. It's really luck of the draw where you happen to be at the point that your family gets caught up in this situation. You might be in a place where the child welfare department has where you're at the caseworker assigned to your particular family really goes to the trouble that is required in order to keep the family together, in order to make a plan of activities that the family can actually carry out and can accomplish. But because there is no clear policy, even within a particular state's child welfare department, child welfare workers are basically on their own having to figure out, well, what are all the different things I could propose, and how am I supposed to communicate with ICE, and what do I do when someone has been deported? One thing we have found that helps is to work with the consulates of other countries to help deported parents get, you know, carry out a reunification plan and get their kids back. But many child welfare workers have no idea that that's an option, and many parents have no idea that that's an option once they are deported. So there needs to be a rethinking of the way in which ICE carries out immigration policy, but also there needs to be the actual creation of clear and consistent policies for child welfare departments to follow. And there are so many innovative possibilities, including the Skype possibility and including alternatives to detention, that there's really no reason that we could not solve this problem.
We're talking with Rin Ku Sen, President and Executive Director of the Applied Research Center. What's your website, Rinku, where people can get this information and read it for themselves?
Our website is arc.org, mm-hmm. and it's certainly on the homepage, but you can also go directly to the reports page, which will be at arc.org/shattered families.
Okay. Now, your report is not explicitly about Alabama, but I'm sure you're up to speed on what's been going on there. They passed a law that was even more draconian than Arizona's, and it has produced some very painful but remarkable reactions, where parents pulled their kids out of school. The Tyson chicken processing plant had to shut down for a period of time because the workers there were afraid to report because many of them thought that they might be subject to deportation. But the most ugly part of this was the way that the law required educators to examine their classrooms. And I believe in some cases, teachers were even required to ask students whether, A, they were citizens, or, B, their parents are. And this kind of big brother approach is really just un-American, in my view. And it amounts to a violation of fundamental human rights that I think is not only unconstitutional, but unconscionable.
Yeah, I really think that Americans, as a collective body, we make the best decisions when we really understand what all of the consequences of those decisions are. And when we make immigration policy, we need to be clear that it doesn't just affect the institutions that manage immigration. It also affects our schools, our hospitals, our workplaces, our neighborhoods, and that, and among the consequences, there are some that really run counter to the value we place on families being able to be together and families being able to take care of each other. And you know, we need to do some very hard thinking about whether our approaches to immigration are creating consequences that are not only expensive financially, but also really costing us too much in terms of our national soul, in terms of who we are as Americans, and in terms of what we value. And I think that our study on child welfare and immigration enforcement was really motivated by the heartbreaking stories we were hearing initially, just here and there, before we had the resources to look into it deeply. And, you know, every American has to make his or her own set of decisions about this, but we should be thinking very hard about what it means for our image of ourselves as Americans that we're willing to let this kind of thing happen to little kids and to families.
Your report also includes a number of policy recommendations, and I commend you for this because it's always important not just to identify a problem, but to offer healthy and appropriate solutions. So tell me a little bit on the federal level. There's a reference here into the Child Citizen Protection Act. Now, what I've heard mostly from the Republican House of Representatives is misguided efforts to try to pass laws that would be patently unconstitutional related to what they derisively call anchor babies. In other words, they want to rewrite the Constitution to deny citizenship to people who are born here. And that is a fundamental in the Constitution. I don't think that that can be amended by an act of Congress, but that doesn't seem to stop them from introducing or talking about this kind of legislation, mostly for political gain. What is the status of any kind of healthy approach, such as this described Child Citizen Protection Act, Rinku?
Well, the status of the healthy approaches is still, they need, those positive approaches need a lot of support. The Child Citizen Protection Act has been introduced but hasn't had a lot of traction. Franken and Woolsey have developed another piece of policy called the HELP Act that would also provide some relief for families with U.S. citizen children and parents who are in danger of being deported. But for either one of those ideas to take hold, Congress needs to hear from Americans in no uncertain terms, in the strongest possible terms, that it is not worth it to us to divide up families in order to pursue immigration enforcement, that we need to look for other ways, and that the integrity of the family has to be really a high priority for us as we're making policy. The other solutions that need to be taken up, one big one really is that there's a clock that starts ticking on the child welfare side. If a parent has been out of touch with the child and with the department for a certain period of time, by federal law it's 15 months out of 22 consecutive months, then the Child Welfare Department is required to actually move toward what is called the termination of parental rights. That's when you say this parent is no longer this child's parent and the child will remain either in foster care or will be eligible for adoption. That clock needs to be stopped when a parent is involved in immigration enforcement. Similarly, the pressure that ICE has to deport huge numbers of people and to deport them quickly, that deportation process needs to be stopped. If ultimately, I don't think this is the only decision that can be made, but if ultimately the system decides a person needs to be deported, then at the very least, the family should be together through that process. But the system could also easily decide, by ICE's own rules and regulations and own guidelines, it could decide not to deport that person, and that would obviously be the better outcome. Either way, though, the family needs to have a chance to resolve its situation before the kids are taken away forever or the parent is deported.
Now, Rinku, what you just described, this policy of if you're out of touch 15 out of 22 consecutive months, you stand to lose your rights as a parent, That can be used in an ugly and manipulative way because INS has sole discretion over how long a parent is held. And as we've discussed, many of them are unable to communicate even with family members or courts who require their participation. So all of the control is in the hands of ICE. And it's not too far-fetched or anti-American to suggest that they would hold somebody for 16 months and say, well, it's too bad. You're out of luck, and we're going to separate you from your children who are citizens, and eventually we will ship you back to your native country. And that kind of control without checks and balances, without appropriate oversight, and as we know, these facilities where they are held are ugly and below our constitutional standards of that ban cruel and unusual punishment. So this whole cycle is one of great cruelty, and it is under the control of bureaucrats who could operate differently without changes in statute, simply by amending policies and using humane evaluation of individual cases.
That's right. Using humane evaluation of individual cases, using the discretion that is supposed to exist for immigration judges as well as for ICE agents. And child welfare departments also have a lot of discretion. They can decide whether or not to move toward that that ultimate severing, that ultimate separation, the permanent separation. And child welfare departments need to remember that they need to be guided by the principle of family unity as well, and they need to do absolutely everything that is possible to do to locate the parent and to make sure that the child and the parent can be together again. And so ICE needs to make it possible for child welfare departments to do their job, and child welfare departments need to stick to the principle of family unity and not decide, for example, that it is that a child is better off in the United States in foster care rather than in Guatemala or India or Jamaica with their actual family.
Finally, Rinku, at the local level, there is a great deal of tension between local agencies, and I hail from what's called a sanctuary city. San Francisco has taken a position that local police do not actively feed people to ICE. They try to maintain a separation so that non-citizens who are residents here will make contact with police authorities either to cooperate in an investigation or enforcement or to protect themselves or their children. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts about this very tense situation, because even under President Obama, we've seen a very hard line from the ICE Division of Homeland Security. And also, we have seen a lot of local law enforcement and legislative officials refuse to cooperate with the most extreme policies of ICE.
Yeah. Well, in our study, we did definitely find that local enforcement of immigration policies, so in the places where the police are involved doing immigration enforcement, that definitely makes this problem worse. A family in that situation is about 29%, 30% more likely to be separated permanently than in a city where that local law enforcement is not acting on immigration policy. So there needs to be a real rethinking of programs, federal government programs like the 287 G program, which deputizes local police officers to be immigration agents, and like the Secure Communities program, which is the one that most recently governors have and police chiefs have been saying, we're going to opt out of that, we're not going to participate in that, and ICE has insisted that opting out is not a possibility. They're making it mandatory. But we know that local law enforcement working on immigration policy makes it actually makes communities less safe because people are afraid to report crime and to report violence, like domestic violence. And it also really feeds into the situation in which any kind of interaction with law enforcement will shove a parent into immigration detention and put them on the path to deportation. And if they have kids in the child welfare system, will make it impossible for that family to be united.
Well, Rinku, thank you for detailing this important study that you and your organization have released. Again, my listeners can read it for themselves at arc.org. That's arc.org, and that stands for the Applied Research Center. Rinku Sen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Share it far and wide with your friends and even some undocumented people, okay?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.